and your first speaker today, Melissa Friedland. Melissa, whenever you're ready to begin.
Okay, thank you, Jean, and good day, everyone. I want to welcome you all and thank you for tuning in to our second Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar of this fiscal year. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment at EPA. I'm very glad you've joined us today as we discuss how Superfund Redevelopment can provide an opportunity for communities to pursue local public health priorities, including access to new health services, as well as recreational resources. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI as we like to call it, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly series about the reuse of Superfund sites. These webinars share site reuse success stories as well as challenges with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. So here's what we'll be covering today. I'm going to share a little bit about SRI before we begin our discussion of our site-specific examples and planning tools. And our webinar today is centered on EPA's outreach and engagement with several communities in the Jacksonville area, Jacksonville, Florida. After that, we'll hear from Tanya Spencer, a community involvement coordinator from EPA's Region 4, who will present the Jacksonville Ash and Brown's Dump Superfund alternative sites in Jacksonville, Florida. And Tanya will walk us through the history of industrial activities in the area and provide some background on the sites and the neighborhoods where the sites are located. And following her will be Joe Alfano, a remedial project manager also from EPA's Region 4, who's going to talk about the cleanup of sites and the long-term management approach at those sites. Joe will also share how reuse took place at the site and the importance of collaboration among stakeholder groups. And following him, we'll hear from Miranda Maupin, a program manager with SCIO, an EPA contractor, to talk about EPA's involvement in the Jacksonville, Florida community and how EPA worked with the community toward community health goals. Her presentation will focus on sharing the integrated health assessment planning tool. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use supports that mission. Reuse is a priority for EPA and an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. It's important to note, and I like to say this at least once, that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Former industrial sites, like those we'll talk about today, pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. There are many excellent examples of site reuse from all over the country, everything from pollinator habitat to homes to shopping centers. And I would encourage all of you to visit the SRI website to find more in-depth information. The link to the SRI website is here. Okay. And if you look under the photograph, you'll see the link to the SRI website. Okay. So have a technical difficulty here. I would also encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the SRI website to learn more about the specific organizations that have partnered with SRI to assist in Superfund site reuse. And collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. SRI currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and Pollinator Partnership, or P2. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities to explore reuse opportunities and available resources for their local Superfund sites. So one final note, please feel free to ask questions of our presenters. We'll try to answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. We'll have some time at the end for remaining questions. So with that, Tanya is going to kick off our discussion of reusing contaminated sites to pursue local public health priorities with an introduction to the Jacksonville Ash and Browns dump sites. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. For anybody that has just joined that didn't hear, my name is LaTanya Spencer, and I'm the Community Involvement Coordinator for the Jacksonville Ash site and the Browns dump site. So I'm going to start by giving some background information on both sites. And then we're going to talk about some of the site history and some of the challenges that we've had at the site. We're going to start with the site background on the Jacksonville Ash site. The Jacksonville Ash site actually includes three separate areas in Jacksonville, Duval County, Florida. They are the Forest Street incinerator site, the Fifth and Cleveland incinerator site, and Lonnie C. Miller. So there are three different areas. They're a couple of miles apart, but pretty much in the same vicinity. We're going to start with the Forest Street incinerator. The Forest Street incinerator is part of the site that covers about 370 acres. It's near U.S. Interstate 95, and the area is actually mixed residential and commercial. It surrounds McCoy's Creek to the north, single-family homes to the south and west, and a mix of commercial and industrial businesses to the southeast. Was someone saying something? Okay. 10.5 acres of the site includes a former location of an incinerator facility and portions of Forest Street Park and Forest Park Head Start School, which has been closed and demolished at this time. The second part of the site is the Fifth and Cleveland incinerator. The Fifth and Cleveland incinerator portion of the site covers 520 acres. It is also adjacent to Interstate 95 and is primarily residential. It includes single-family homes, multifamily apartments, and four schools. 9 acres of the site includes a community center called Emmett Reed and also Emmett Reed Park, and it also has a new tennis facility, which Joe will talk about later as part of the reuse. The third part of the Jacksonville Ash site is the Lonnie C. Miller Senior Park, and it covers about 250 acres in a residential area. The park is located less than 1/4 mile northeast of U.S. Highway 1, and it also has single-family homes to the north, south, and east, as well as commercial businesses to the west. And it also is located east of a park and the Rebalt River. The incinerator at 5th and Cleveland actually operated as the City of Jacksonville's municipal solid waste from 1910 until 1960. The City of Jacksonville disposed of combustion ash, clinker, and ash residues on the incinerator properties and ash spread to some of the surrounding areas, as well as on the land that was later redeveloped into Lonnie C. Miller Park. After the incinerator operations ended, uses on the Lonnie C. Miller Senior Park site included a construction debris depository, a quail farm, and a junkyard. Currently, the land uses, again, are residential, commercial, and recreational, and also public service. Most of the residential areas in this area are low-income housing units. Now, for the second part for the Superfund alternative approach, I'm going to talk about the Jacksonville Ash and Browns dump sites together because the information for that will be the same. So we're going to go on to talk about the background for the Browns dump site. Okay. The Burns dump site is an area in the city of Jacksonville where there was a landfill that operated from the late 1940s until the mid-1950s. Brown's Dump is a 250-acre site and is residential and industrial. The site includes, included Mary McLeod Bethune Elementary School, which was later closed. It also includes Jacksonville Electric Authority, JEA, substation, some single-family homes, and multifamily apartment complexes. This is also another low-income residential area. From the late 1940s until the mid-1950s, the city of Jacksonville operated a landfill at this site, also disposed of ash from municipal incinerators. The city closed the landfill in 1953, and Duval County School Board obtained the property in 1955 through condemnation for construction of a school. During this time, development of the land surrounding the landfill for homes and apartment complex took place. The Mary McLeod Bethune Elementary School was closed in 2001. And Joe will talk more about this, currently the Brown Dump School has been purchased and is being used as a charter school, and the majority of the cleanup of the soils has already taken place in the area where the school is now operating. There are also some residential parcels in the area that have been cleaned up right behind the school and across the street. So now as we talk about the Superfund alternative approach, I want to let everyone know that if I say Superfund alternative, it is also synonymous to PRP lead site, which is potentially responsible party. And it is also the same if I say NPL caliber site, which is the natural priority list caliber site. All three of those are used interchangeably. So if I flip up and say one or the other, we're still talking about the Superfund alternative approach. When we talk about Superfund alternative approach, it simply means that these particular sites were not listed on the national priorities list because we had a potentially responsible party. In this particular case, the potentially responsible party, or PRPs, are the city of Jacksonville. So as a result, EPA and the state enter into an agreement with the city of Jacksonville for cleanup of these sites. And so that is the Superfund alternative approach. And what we'll say for this particular situation is that the city took the lead, but there's also additional PRPs that are searched throughout enforcement process. So basically, the negotiated legal agreement with the city of Jacksonville, which is the site's primary potentially responsible party, is to investigate and clean up the site. So EPA has oversight along with the state to clean up, monitor, and oversee the activities for cleanup. And Joe is going to talk more about this for the reuse in the areas in the Jacksonville ash areas. But in 2006, there was a short-term cleanup at the 5th and Cleveland area. And they dug up some ash and redeveloped the area. So again, that's going to be talked about by Joe. But basically, the Superfund alternative sites are negotiated agreements with EPA along with the state to oversee what the potentially responsible parties are doing. And also, one of the reasons why it's very important to use this approach for the community and those that are stakeholders with these sites is we have been asked and pretty much tried to live up to getting sites back into reuse, which is what this presentation is all about. And so that is one of the reasons it's important that we use this approach, because we could move forward. Otherwise, if the site is listed on a national priorities list, we have to compete for funding to move through the process. However, if you have a potentially responsible party at a Superfund alternative site, the money is available to move forward and have a continuous cleanup process. So that's two of the reasons why it's very important to use this approach when possible, because you can move forward a little faster. Jacksonville, Florida, some of the community background. First, let me say that there are a lot of sites in the Jacksonville area. When we say overburden communities, City of Jacksonville had several sites. Some of the Superfund sites that we worked on in the area is Pickettville, White House Oil, Hips Road, Coleman Evans, Yellowwater Road, Cecilfield Naval Air Station, Jacksonville Naval Air Station are some of the ones that we worked on and pretty much completed. Probably have to do 5-year reviews on those sites. But some of the current sites that are active that we're currently working on are the ones that we're talking about today, the Jacksonville Ash Sites and Brown's Dump Site. And not too far from these two sites, we also have the Fairfax Wood Treater Site as well as the Kerr-McGee Tronach Site. So there is an overburden in the community with sites within a few miles of each other. And these sites that I've just named today are only Superfund sites. These don't include the sites that are being taken on by the state. So there are several sites in the area that are taken on by the state as well as operating facilities that may be under RCRA that's still operating. So there is an overburden of sites in the city of Jacksonville. And basically, that's some of the history of the industry in the area, is that a lot of these homes in the areas, the majority are environmental justice areas or low minority income areas. And a lot of these homes were built around these operating facilities and operating properties because they provided jobs. Some of the areas at the time were considered to be up and coming. So a lot of the history of industry in the areas that these homes and these areas were built around to support the jobs and everything that was coming into the area. The last thing is some of the historic challenges. Because these areas of low-income minority, one of the main things that they focus on in the area is economic redevelopment. They want jobs in the area. They want the blight out of the area. Specifically in the Brown Dump area, a lot of the homes are vacant. There's a lot of vacant lots. They're finding it hard to get people to move into the area. There's a lot of rental properties, so people are pretty transient in and out. So it's an area where some of the community people really want to grow the area and have some younger generation of people coming in, but it's hard to get that when you don't have the support of growth in the area to make it look more urban, I would guess, like some of the other areas. Now, in the Jacksonville Ash areas, although there are some low-income areas, they are working on several projects over in there that areas of improvement that Joe will talk about later that will show that they are making efforts to improve the area. And there's not too much vacant land in the Jacksonville Ash areas, but I do know that they have a lot of acreage at the Superfund sites that they're looking into using for different opportunities. And these are some pictures that have been included from some of the meetings that we've had. We've had a lot of meetings in Jacksonville, some on individual basis going door to door because we are cleaning up individual properties. And currently, I'm not sure of the number, but I know it's probably about over 1,500 properties have been cleaned up to date. And I think there's a couple of hundred more that we have to complete. But one of the processes that we did work with Hester Group, which branded the project as Project Newground, PNG. And one of the things we did was have a combination of an availability session and a meeting where we invited people in. As you can see, there's a sign here that talks about access agreements. We had an access agreement table. We also had a table for the health department. We had a table for the state of Florida. We also had a table for EPA. So these are just a couple of pictures from that particular meeting that we had. And this is the same meeting. As you can see to the left, I am passing out pencils to encourage people to sign their access agreements while they're at the meeting, which was a good way because we had a whole lot of them to get. And to the right, we're talking to individuals on an individual basis, which is a part of the availability session, is that people get to talk to you individually either about their property or individually about questions that they probably would not ask in a meeting in a public forum. And here, my previous supervisor, Frieda Lockhart, is here in the pink jacket, and we're talking to one of the community leaders, Ms. Celia Miller, who has a nonprofit organization called Mania. So she's very active in the community as well. And we have several community activists that came out for the Jacksonville Ash and the Brown Stump site. Here is another part of the availability session that we had where we actually had parcel boards that showed the different properties and where contamination was suspected to be at the time, highlighting where we needed to get access agreements. And here on the right side in the middle, the young man that's pointing is Mr. Tonsil, who was one of the very active community leaders. He and his wife pretty much led the communities in getting information and also received one of the TAPs that we had, technical assistance plans that we had for the community. And we actually had four technical assistance plans, which worked pretty much just like a technical assistance grant. And here we have more pictures to the left. As you can see, there's another sign for engineers and cleanup where they had a table with contractors that could specifically talk to people about the technical portion. And to your right, we have, again, my former supervisor at that time was Frieda Lockhart. Our division director here is Franklin Hill. And here is Hester of the Hester Group and one of her employees that helped to work with the Project New Ground to help us to get the access agreement. They actually were contracted by the city, and again, EPA with oversight. And here is my contact information, and I will turn it back over to the moderator to see if we have any questions.
Hey, thanks, Tanya. We do have a couple of questions, and the first is, someone is asking, why did some communities and site stakeholders prefer a Superfund alternative approach to an NPO listing?
As I stated earlier, if we would have listed it on the national priorities list, this site probably would have had to compete for funding, which usually slows down the process because you have probably more briefings for the RPM to do. In this particular case, they actually had a potentially responsible party. And usually if we have a potentially responsible party that takes ownership of contaminating the site and they actually have funding to pay, we would like for them to use the Superfund alternative approach opposed to us listing it on a national priorities list and having to compete for Superfund funding.
Okay, great. And another question, Tanya. It sounds like the community involvement at this site kind of changed over time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Actually, back in 2001, when we started working here, pretty much EPA was blamed for everything that happened in Jacksonville in these areas. We had 300, sometimes a little more people to show up for meetings, mostly because they thought that there would be reparations from the EPA for health issues, dilapidation of home issues, communications with the city. So there was a severe distrust of any type of government, whether it be federal, state, or local. They pretty much trusted no one. However, since EPA showed up and they thought we could answer all of their questions, what we had to do was go through a process of restating over and over again what EPA was there to do, and also get the City of Jacksonville City Council, as well as the state and the health department, and also ATSDR came out a couple of times to restate our positions and what each person or each entity was there to do and what our roles and responsibilities were. It took some years to build trust. We were accused of taking people's homes because when we went door-to-door to get access agreements, we had one community group that told people that the city and EPA were working together to take their homes, to rebuild. It was genocide. So we had to overcome that. We actually went door-to-door to talk to people, sometimes having to talk to people about their tax information because that is why their homes were being taken. They were not paying their taxes because they were being told that their property was worth zero and they shouldn't pay their taxes on it. So basically, that's why the homes were being taken. A lot of the people, especially in the Brown Dump area, were elderly. They did not quite understand what was going on. So again, we made an effort to go talk to them one-on-one. We knocked on doors. We walked the streets. We did that for several months. We also had, at the time, Congresswoman Corrine Brown actually came and walked the streets with us to help people get involved and getting the access agreement signed. Another issue that was going on is that there was a major lawsuit going on at the time, and EPA does not get involved in civil suits or tort suits of any kind. So that was another area where we had to actually explain that we were not a part of that. We had people showing up for meetings thinking that they were signing up for the lawsuit to get money. So we had to consistently explain to them that's not what we were there for, but we could provide information on what we were trying to do towards the cleanup and, you know, put the area back into reuse. And actually had some situations where we had some meetings where people actually got up and left after we stated the purpose of the meeting and why we were there. So at this point, working with the Hester Group, which is a group that was contracted by the City of Jacksonville, and they actually had us to come in. They had several contractors that they were looking at, but they chose Hester Group. And we have worked with the Hester Group to get access agreements, along with the City of Jacksonville to get access agreements, temporary relocation for some of the residents, since we were doing individual cleanup. And Joe will talk to you later about the Superfund job training we did. So we did quite a few things to try to bring some hope to the community and to work with them to build their trust. At this point, it's really quiet. And one of the things that we had to do, as I stated before, we just had to keep going back and keep resetting our purpose and what we were there for, and build the trust.
Thank you, Tanya. That's great, and I hope you'll stick around because I know there'll be more questions later. I want to turn it over now to Joe Alfano. Joe?
Yes.
Please go ahead.
All right. I am I'm Joe Alfano. I'm the RPM for the Jacksonville Ash and Browns dump site. As Tanya has mentioned, there are actually four sites. Jacksonville Ash is three separate sites. Two were the former municipal incinerators. and two of them, including the Browns dump, were dump sites for the incinerator ash. So the incinerator ash contained lead, arsenic, pHs, and some dioxin. And of course, those kind of got, the ash got spread around the incinerators, and then it got dumped at the other two sites, Lonnie Miller Park and Brown's Dump. The remedy is basically an excavation of up to 2 feet of ash-contaminated soil on residential properties. Some city-owned properties could receive fill if it was allowable and to change the elevation. So some of them would have 2 feet of fill placed over contaminated soil. And, of course, there's institutional controls that for contamination that is left in place. We investigated about 3,200 parcels, and we're over about 1,600 parcels remediated to date. The remediation game began in 2010 and is nearing completion. This is Western Jacksonville. I do not see my green arrow. Gene, is there a green arrow? Oh, thank you. This is downtown Jacksonville, and this is the western side of Jacksonville. This is your two incinerator sites, and this is Brown's Dump and Lonnie Miller Park, which is the other dump site. Okay, Brown's Dump, this central parcel is the Mary McLeod Bethune that Tanya mentioned earlier, and the school grounds around it. So this was a school property, and the property around it. Now the building is being rehabbed and is being turned into a church and community center. Lonnie Miller Park was a park with some residential houses around it. Most of the contamination was on the back side of the park. Right now there's a proposed sports complex that would go and cover most of the park, but we haven't done the remediation yet, and the sports complex is still in the planning stage. This is the Far Street, one of the incinerator sites. I lost my green arrow again. Oh, sorry. The incinerator was located here, and we will talk about the Animal Care and Control Facility, which was developed on this piece of remediated land. The incinerator was located here, and you can see the residential properties, and there are also some commercial properties mixed in. And pretty much anything that was green wasn't remediated, and after that, everything else was either going, needs to be remediated or has been remediated. This is 5th and Cleveland. This is the other incinerator site. The incinerator was located right here. It's been a park for many years. There's a community center that's been based here for many years. When we talk about the Mila Via Washington Tennis Center, it is now located in this property, which used to have the incinerator. So the incinerator site itself has now been redeveloped as a tennis complex. So where we're at right now, like you said, we started with about 3,200 parcels. This is from November, but at that time we had remediated about 1,650 parcels. You can see we're about 90% complete overall, and each of the sections of the sites are basically, most of them are only 90%, or already over 90%. And as of November, we had removed about 650,000 tons of contaminated soil from these four neighborhoods. So this is pretty tight. These are pretty small neighborhoods. A lot of them are very small parcels. So The remediation has been pretty intricate. You've got to work around sidewalks and piping in the yard. You can have piping you have to work around. Of course, you have foundations. So this is pretty intricate work with a small backhoe. You know, we have bigger areas. You get to use a bigger backhoe. But, you know, this is some really hard fought remediation. And part of the institutional control after confirmation sampling is if there is still contamination, this fencing is put down so that in the future, if someone's digging through, they can run into the fencing and know that there's contamination and should contact the city so that the city can help with any work that needs to go on out there. And of course, since you're remediating, some of these old houses have you have your basic cinder block type of foundation, so that all lends to the problem of trying to get up close to these type of structures without undermining foundations of buildings. And of course, there are also trees, which is another issue. We didn't. Property owners did get to weigh in on when to keep trees. This is, of course, a small tree. Some of these trees are large oaks that can, root mat could cover half of a property at times. So that is another issue. You try to take as much off the root mat as you can and then backfill on top of it, which is just part of this type of remediation. So early on in 2009, we had three schools that had contamination in the schoolyard, so we did a fast-track remediation. Basically, we let the city of Jacksonville prioritize the design for these schools. So we went in 2009. We did it in the summer when the kids were not in was not at the school. This is the Darnell Cookman School. So there's school building, so basically you had remediation occurring right up to the building, and there's some of our fencing because there's contamination still left underneath the backfill. This is probably going to be 2 foot of backfill on top of the fencing. This was actually their football field behind the building. So we had to remove 2 foot of ash contamination basically from their football field. Actually, their track field went around it. It was inside their track field. And since this was a bigger area, of course, you get to use a bigger backhoe, which helps. And so this was a remediation of their football field. And this is the John E. Ford School. Once again, the schoolyard was remediated. And you can see trying to get up to these buildings and, you know, not undermine foundations and just the need to go through these entire yards and remove 2 foot of contamination. General, and these aren't directly related to the three sites, but it does come under the heading of just general community outreach and involvement. Jacksonville in 2011 was named as an EJA showcase community, so there were community outreaches and meetings that were held in Jacksonville 2011. As Tanya mentioned, we had 4 technical assistant plan community groups that were awarded grants, and so one for each site, and each of the community groups got to hire a technical assistant. This was specific to the sites. There was actually a Superfund job training initiative for these two sites, which had the training program that, it started with 100 or so people going through the training program. It includes the hazmat 40-hour health and safety training, other classes that were relevant to working for an environmental company, and even had some life skill training involved. At my last check, there's still about 20 graduates working on the remediation, which is still ongoing. Not everyone makes it through the training program, so it's not like there were 100 and now there's 20. A smaller number actually makes it through the training program. And also there was a Jacksonville Integrated Planning project. This was kind of a community-based and cross-agency project that looked at a health zone one, and its general goals were to take an area-wide approach and build local stakeholder capacity, and it was to integrate integrate quality of life and environmental issues. So basically, this is Health Unit 1, Health Zone 1 runs all along this area, and you can see my sites are in here, but those are not the only Superfund site. There are actually three under Superfund sites within Health Zone 1. Of course, mine are the biggest Superfund sites in Health Zone 1. But the idea is to look at this entire health zone, which has a lot of bad health outcomes from several different indices. There was like diabetes, you know, infant mortality, just several health indexes that it has a higher rate is in Health Zone 1. So it was really for the entire Health Zone 1, but of course our Superfund sites were somewhat integrated into this. So the goals were basically to have the community coalition help form the prioritize the strategies for revitalization. So they had community group based input groups, and they basically came up with three quality of life goals. One is to improve the health access to health care, improve the access to open space, and improve access to healthy and affordable food. What the community work groups came up with, the healthcare access work group came up with having some mobile health clinics that would move around the county and use that as a way to be able to locate a permanent healthcare facility based on the need for the mobile healthcare clinics. The Healthy Affordable Food Access Work Group came up with supporting a local food system with local food co-ops, basically selling locally grown food. And back to more specifically to these sites, in 2015, Jacksonville Ash and Brown's Dump did get an Excellence in Reuse Award. Basically, these first three are private developments that were at the Forest Street incinerator site. And there's the Mary McLeod Bethune property with the church and community center. There's a Jacksonville Animal Care and Protective Facility at Forest Street. The Malavia Washington Youth Tennis Center is at the 5th and Cleveland site. And we have the proposed sports complex development at Lonnie Miller Park. This is the Animal Care and Control Facility. It actually started, basically it's used for, it has rescue and adoption services and some general pet education for the community. It started out looking like this. It was a bunch of old foundations for buildings, slabs, and some contamination. So it was remediated, and after it was remediated, they have a nice new animal care and control facility. This was the location of the 5th and Cleveland incinerator. It had been a park before, as I said, across the street over here is a community center. It's been there for a while. This was a park, but we did a non-time critical removal and actually remediated this property, which was the incinerator itself. and basically put, the Malavea Washington Youth Center. Basically, the Malavea Washington Youth Foundation is a foundation that helps low-income children learn life skills by using tennis as the basis for their program. So it's a very good program, and now on the incinerator site is this tennis center, which still gets lots of use, so it was a very good reuse for that site. This was the old Mary McLeod Bethune School. It was closed down because the buildings were not in the best of shape. So a very nice woman, Dr. Rhonda Doe, has purchased the land from the city who owns it before, and has taken on the challenge of rehabbing the building and building her church and community center here. And of course, there was a lot of property associated with the schoolyard. So this is in process of remediating the back of the schoolyard. And of course, the fencing was because the confirmation sampling showed some contamination in those areas. And of course, backfill, come back and backfill over after the remediation. These are the three private developments. There is the this was an apartment complex. This is a commercial complex with shops and a grocery store. This is a mixed-use development with an amphitheater and a pond out front. Those were privately funded reuse redevelopments. Now, Lonnie C. Miller Park, I showed it to you earlier, was a rather large park in the northern part of Jacksonville. A lot of the back part of the land was not used. It was a dump site for this ash. So right now there is a plan to develop that that park. Basically, there's plans for a trail, an amphitheater, some tennis courts, basketball courts, three multi-use fields, and of course picnic pavilions and parking lots, another trail on the eastern side, baseball fields, and the associated buildings and restaurant and concessions, and two more multi-use fields. This is what that's going to look like. So you've got the basketball courts, tennis courts, and one of the multi-use fields, amphitheater with a pond, and this is the western trails that circle those facilities. Phase two will be mostly, there is some stormwater work for a pond to control surface runoff and flooding and that type of stuff, and also there's going to be an eastern trail which goes down near the river that is adjacent to the eastern side of the site. Phase three will also be on the side of the site. This is going to be baseball fields, a couple of more multi-use fields, and that is just a track that's going to be around the other multi-use field from the earlier phase. So that is the general plan for Lonnie Miller Park. And that, in general, is the reuse that has been planned for the Jacksonville Ash and Brown's Dump site. And
okay, Joe.
Anybody have any questions?
Yeah, we've got a couple, Joe. Thanks very much. Can you talk about how the community needs shape the redevelopment plan for the Lonnie Miller Park?
Yes. I mean, this was further up in Jacksonville. There weren't a lot of really big facilities for sports up that way. So basically, there was just a need for sports complexes, places where they could have organized sports, there just was not. It was very sparse and didn't really have those type of facilities in that neighborhood.
Okay, and another question is, can you just go over a little bit about all the sources of funding for the cleanup and then for the reuse?
Well, the sources of funding were all from the City of Jacksonville. The City of Jacksonville is the primary PRP, so they have funded all the cleanup, and you know they have taken the opportunity to integrate developments that they have come up with over the years into the remediation. You know, sometimes when they knew in advance what was happening on the property, the remediation was tailored so that they could remediate, and then a contractor could come in afterwards and, you know, fill to where they need it to and get our 2 foot that we need to consider, 2 foot of uncontaminated soil and development just proceeded. So funding all came from the City of Jacksonville. Of course, some of the reuse, like the private developments, were private development money, but the animal care and control and the tennis center were, the tennis center was a joint project between the City of Jacksonville and the Mayavilla Washington Foundation. And the school property is actually at this point just one woman's trying to do what she can do.
That's great. And let's take one more before we move on to Miranda, and that is, can you talk a little bit about placing institutional controls on the site and then what the enforcement, how you would enforce them?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you repeat that?
Okay, yeah. Can you talk just a little bit about how EPA decided to place the ICs at the site and what kinds of things they did for enforcement?
Well, the ICs, it's just a very extensive site, as you can tell. So our main IC is based on, since the city is the PRP, there's a program that the city, when people get permits through the city flags those permits and gives information to the contractor, utility company, whoever's going to be doing the work. And they are made aware of that there may be ash contamination, and they're supposed to contact the city if they run into some ash or they run into some of our fencing left there. So that is one of the major institutional controls. It's just a an oversight program for the city, and that is the major one. And like I said, we have our markers that we put down during remediation to help people know if they get into some place that has contamination.
That's great, Joe. Thank you very much. Please stick around. I know there'll be questions toward the end. Let's move on now to Miranda Maupin. Miranda?
Great. Thank you. This is Miranda Maupin, and I'm with SCIO. We are a contractor supporting the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. And this afternoon, I was just going to take a few minutes to share a planning tool developed by SRI to support healthy communities. SRI developed the Integrated Health Assessment Tool, which provides a step-by-step process for considering opportunities to improve health and wellness during a reuse assessment process. And SRI focused on Jacksonville to develop and pilot the tool, and then summarize the process in a guidance document that I can share with you later, so that this process can be replicated at any suitable Superfund site. So, as presented in this map earlier, this portion of Jacksonville has multiple Superfund sites. The Fairfax site right in the middle, see if I can get the pointer here, You can probably see it right there in the middle of the map. That's where we piloted the health assessment guidance. So the Fairfax Street wood treater site had active wood treating operations from 1980 until 2010, resulting in contamination of site soils and neighborhood residential yards and school property. After conducting emergency removal actions at the site in 2010 and 2011, EPA Region 4 placed the site on the NPL list and initiated a remedial investigation feasibility study. And it was part of this in parallel to the RIFS that SRI supported a reuse assessment for the site to help inform the risk assessment and potential alternatives. So the study area around the Fairfax site, it had had a declining population, primarily African American, and a median household income of just over $21,000. And as you can see, the site is right there in the middle, indicated by a star. And even though the site was industrial, you can see that it's primarily surrounded by residential land use, which is shown in yellow, or institutional land uses shown in blue, such as schools or community centers. So in this case, it seemed really no longer suitable to have an industrial site right there in the middle of a residential neighborhood. So the reuse planning process typically includes four steps. The first step is to identify community goals. And typically this is done by meeting with a range of stakeholders, including community residents, local government, other community organizations that have a vested interest in the site and the neighborhood. And goals may be broad, such as residential, commercial, industrial, or they may be very specific, such as sports fields or solar reuse. The second step is to determine what is feasible on the site given the physical features of the site. That could be like natural features such as a creek, or it could be the size of the site, or it could be a remaining building or parking area. Also the infrastructure, what are the institutional controls either in place or anticipated, or the long-term remedial features. So important factors could include the size of the property, anticipated use restrictions, caps that need to remain in place, or groundwater treatment systems that may eventually come out but will be there over 10 or 20 years. The third step evaluates the area around the site. Is it primarily industrial or residential neighborhood? Are there natural features such as a creek or open space? Is the site easily accessible to the highway, rail, or other infrastructure? And then the last step is to integrate the community goals, the site suitability, and the surrounding land use to develop future land use options. At the Fairfax site, the community was interested in retail services along with a health clinic and a mini neighborhood police station. The integrated health assessment builds on this reuse planning process by adding a few considerations to each step. So for the first step, when meeting with stakeholders about goals for the site, you can also ask what would help promote community health and wellness in the broader neighborhood. Secondly, when reviewing surrounding land use, this can include identifying the nearest health clinics and hospitals, but this review can also look for gaps in access to healthy food, open space, and infrastructure that promotes active modes of transportation. Then when evaluating site suitability, future use options may also consider what could be improved in the surrounding neighborhood. So in other words, rather than just focusing on that site, there may be opportunities in the broader neighborhood that can be considered as well. And then lastly, when developing future use options, it's important to bring other partners to the table who can help implement both on-site and off-site recommendations. So this might be the county health department, it might be local community organizations, it might be the local government, or you know, national foundations or funding partners that can help meet those broader community goals. So what's included in the tool? The tool is summarized in this guidance document, which can be found on the SRI website and downloaded. The document includes how to select a community to pilot this process, gives an overview of the framework, and a case study example of the Jacksonville pilot. So how to select a candidate community. Communities that might be a good candidate for this process include communities that have had concerns with health disparities or environmental justice, communities that are struggling with a number of environmental concerns, such as multiple contaminated sites, poor air quality, or residential contamination, or communities that are under-resourced in terms of lack of infrastructure and services. The framework provides a quick checklist shown there on the right that can be used during stakeholder interviews. These questions just help identify what gaps may be present in the community in terms of health services, but also some of those wellness amenities that we talked about, like access to food, healthy food, open space, and active modes of transportation. There are also resources for data sources if you're interested in a more in-depth analysis. So for the Fairfax pilot, SRI walked through each of these steps to develop a set of recommendations. In this case, the study determined that the neighborhood could benefit from the following health and wellness features. A dental clinic or vision facility, a federally qualified health center, a grocery store or neighborhood retail services, affordable housing, and arts and cultural facilities. And we determined that the site may be suitable for any of these uses. However, the retail size would need to be kind of adjusted and scaled down to the neighborhood. And there may need to be improvements in access and transit to increase the service area for retail services. So lastly, I just wanted to share some of the benefits of the process. We invite you to consider applying the integrated health assessment to a community that you're currently supporting. And what we found is that there are multiple benefits when engaging stakeholders in a future use process. It can help move discussions from a place of frustration that's focused on the past to more positive discussion focused on future possibilities. The process can identify even small ways that the site can provide health benefits, such as providing a trail or trees, even if the site remains in industrial use. And if well done, the process can also bring partners to the table to support implementation, including community goals that may extend beyond the site. So that concludes what I had to share. Unless folks have some questions, I can turn it back over to the moderator.
Thanks, Miranda. We do have some questions, which we will pass on to you. I guess the first one is, so what are some roadblocks that communities face when they're planning an integrated health assessment, and how did Jacksonville overcome these roadblocks?
Well, I think one roadblock that may concern, you know, both the EPA site team and the community is a lot of times the community may be focused on a very specific use happening at that Superfund site. And there may be a number of reasons why that might not be feasible. It could just be the site's location or access or even the size of the site. So it could be factors that have nothing really to do with the contamination or the remediation. In other cases, there are limitations due to the remedial plan. For example, there might be institutional controls restricting that particular use at the site, Or it may be that there's long-term remedial features, such as a cap or groundwater features that would prevent the use, that particular use. But I think how we've seen communities overcome this process, and in Jacksonville as well, is by taking a more of an area-wide view when thinking about reuse. It can help both community members and local government kind of take those community goals and sort of sort them to where they may be appropriate in the community. So rather than just saying, nope, we can't, you know, that kind of use will not work on this site, you're able to kind of reframe the discussion and talk about these are the uses that will work on the site given its constraints and opportunities. And then if we look area-wide, here's where some of these other goals could be accomplished if we get the right partners to the table to help implement those. And so an example of that here in Jacksonville was the community group was particularly interested in open space access, and especially access related to water. And in this case, it wasn't able to happen at this particular site that they had in mind in Jacksonville, but through this process, we were able to connect two adjacent neighborhoods, and together, through a collaboration, they were able to apply for a Groundwork USA funding, and so they created a Groundwork USA chapter right there in Jacksonville. That came with funding for staff to actively open work on open space. And so even though the Superfund site couldn't provide that access to water, this collaboration created the resources to provide that open space network, and it may even connect some of the sites and some of the amenities of the different sites that are available.
That's great, Miranda. Thank you. We have a couple of more questions here, not in any particular order, but this one is for Joe. I guess what the person is saying is, what happens when, generally, if you leave waste in place? How do you figure out what the risks are and what kinds of reuse can occur?
You can leave waste in place. Of course, it's easier if it's an industrial site that you can just cap and restrict access. It's a little more difficult if you're in a active residential neighborhood, of course. We did go a little deeper because it's something the state of Florida wanted, so we did remediate the 2-foot for direct contact, which is different than is done on a lot of Superfund sites, which is more like 1-foot. So that gave us a little more cushion as far as people digging into the ash. But as I said, the city is supposed to be on board. We do have databases. The city's supposed to keep a database that keeps track of where this contamination is. If someone is involved in work, they're supposed to supply them with the data of what we know of. If we know there's contamination in place, then the city can supply it to someone doing work in that area and do some oversight of what they're doing. Basically, as long as it stays down below 2-foot, I mean, that's our remedy, and that's acceptable. The only real risk is someone digs it up and leaves it sitting on the surface somewhere, which is what we hope the city oversight will be able to accomplish, and as I said, the city can supply the data, and should they send the reports to the EPA yearly, which tell what's been going on and what type of work has gone on in the IC areas, and then report what type of activities and what kind of oversight has occurred.
Okay. Joe, we got another question for you. Someone's asking about the uncontaminated backfill. Where would that come from?
It came from an area near a landfill further out in northern Jacksonville. Northwest Jacksonville, I believe. So there was just some borrow areas that we sampled, the city sampled and used it as backfill. So it was near the disposal site, so they would bring ash out and, well, they would clean out the trucks and then bring the fill and clean trucks back in to do the backfilling.
Okay, thanks. And I've got another question for Tanya. So you mentioned that the community now is fairly quiet, but what kinds of community involvement activities are ongoing? I guess it's not as frequent maybe, but what sorts of things are happening?
What sort of things are happening now is we're in the process of preparing to update the community involvement plan as Joe is nearing completion, just to go back out. And when we do the community involvement plan this time, it will be more of some of the questions that's being asked today, lessons learned, how can we do things better, would you like to continue to get information, how often. Some of the other things that we do is that we still have a working relationship with the Hester Group, and the Hester Group has they're working with the city, which is the PRP, and we also work with them to get updates. And also for all the community leaders, if they have any questions, they call Joe or they call myself. And if they want us to come down to, they have what they call CPAC, which is a part of their city of Jacksonville, and each zone has a community group for CPAC. So sometimes if they want us to come and speak at the meetings and give an update, we'll do that. Or either we'll do an updated fact sheet, and we'll send the fact sheet out and say, here, this is where we are.
That is great. Thank you very much. I want to move now to the close, and we still have a couple, an opportunity for a few more questions, but I'd like to talk about resources and contacts. And I'll just wait till that comes up on the screen. I want to thank you, Tanya, Joe, and Miranda. It was really great to hear about the successful reuse of Jacksonville Ash and Brown's Dump and the Jacksonville Health Assessment process. And I think it's interesting to hear how EPA engaged with different communities in ways tailored to their unique needs. So to everyone who tuned in, I hope that the presenter discussion today has expanded your knowledge of both the challenges and the possibilities at former industrial sites. So showcasing these successful projects is a very important part of Superfund redevelopment, and we found that sharing case studies and lessons learned is an impactful tool for promoting safe and beneficial reuse. And stories like the ones we heard today allow us to demonstrate how resources can be used effectively and provide inspiration, we hope, for those looking to reuse contaminated properties. And by sharing the story of reuse in Jacksonville, Florida, our presenters have contributed to continued Superfund reuse, so we thank you very much. So I'd like to wrap up our time today by providing you with some resources, and then we'll use our remaining time to take a survey and see if there are any additional questions. Okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning of our time today, SRI has a number of tools and resources available on our website to help as you consider reuse at your site, and the SRI website is included as a link in the additional resources on the right side of your Adobe Connect screen. SRI also has a redevelopment coordinator in each region to support reuse at a site-specific level. And if you'd like more information about an existing reuse project or would like to discuss reuse opportunities at any site near you, please feel free to reach out to your regional coordinator. Okay. If you have any general questions about SRI, please don't hesitate to contact me or Frank Avasato. And what I'd like to do now is, switch the slide view to the survey screen, and I'd like to encourage you all to fill out the survey and let us know what future webinar topics you would benefit from, and add your email address to the bottom left if you'd like to be on our notification list for future webinars. Why don't we do that? Okay. Give everybody a chance to fill out the survey. We do read these very carefully, and we have made changes in how we make our presentations and the topics and all sorts of sort of how these things work. They've changed quite a bit from when we started out, so we really appreciate your taking the time to fill this out.
And I think while we're waiting for just a few more answers to come in for the poll questions, in terms of the answering them, you simply need to check off the boxes to the left of any topics that might be of interest to you. You can scroll up and down and just click that empty box to the left of each item. As noted, if there are text responses, such as entering your email address or suggesting specific topics, you simply need to click your mouse cursor on the empty box beneath the question and then type in your answer and then hit the enter key to submit your message on it. Melissa, would you like to take any additional questions before we close things out today?
I think we've done a pretty good job of doing most of them. I think we're all right. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, let me go ahead and just walk through a few final reminders before we close things out today. And oh, no, looks like we've lost one of our windows. Let me put that right back up there so that everybody can still access those related URLs. I apologize for that. I just wanted to remind everyone that as we highlighted earlier today, this is an ongoing webinar series. If you're interested, you can replay the over 30 previously recorded webinars on this topic that are currently archived on the CLUIN SRI or Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website. So you can go ahead and click on that link and then play any of these webinars back on demand. As soon as today's webinar is currently available, we'll add it to the list of sessions available there, and you'll receive an email with the instructions on how you can access it and replay it back on demand. And I know that one window is a little bit small. We'll go ahead and restore that back down to its appropriate size. I apologize for the maximization there. Walk through just a few other reminder items. If you would like to access a copy of the presentation materials, you'll find that on the seminar homepage, which is hyperlinked on your instructions for today, as well as under the related URLs pod. You scroll up and down on the list on the middle right of your screen, you will see a page that's listed as the seminar archive or seminar homepage. You can click on that and then press the Browse To button to open up that site locally. If you are interested, again, the slides are posted there. Contact information for all of our presenters and organizers is currently listed. And a link to provide feedback for today's session is currently available. I'll be sure to share that with everybody in our interactive Q&A window. I will ask if you could take just a moment and send us your thoughts regarding today's webinar. We do read each and every one of your comments, and that does help us to continue to offer these free sessions online for the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. If you happen to share the line with multiple people, each person can fill out their own version of the seminar feedback form. When you fill out that form, there will be an option that you can click at the bottom to confirm that you participated in the entire session or replayed the entire recorded version. And once you click that box and submit your feedback, you'll have an option to either print or save a PDF participation certificate that will document your attendance in today's webinar. If you need additional assistance in documenting your participation in our webinars, you can feel free to reach out to me directly at ballant.jean@epa.gov. A number of you often will ask if we offer CEUs or PDHs. We do not offer those, but again, if you keep copies of the materials, save your registration emails, and then get one of those participation certificates after you provide feedback, that's usually enough to document your attendance in these sessions with your own respective organizations. I want to thank the over 100 individuals who joined us from all over the country today, as well as our speakers who took time out of their days to share their talks. Thank you so very much for joining us for today's live broadcast. Again, you'll receive an email once the archive is available for playback. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.